Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today, BlackRock's $6 trillion man.
Who is Larry Fink?
The world's largest money manager finally hits the big time as a Jeopardy clue. The French economist behind Elizabeth Warren's tax plan.
These are the best estimates we think, but they could be improved.
Defending the details of a plan that's high on taxes. Jeff Bezos's lofty goals are long in the making.
You quote his high school girlfriend saying the reason he wants to make all this money is so that he can go to space. Right.
The author of a new profile on the Amazon leader's master plan. We've got those stories and much more, from LeBron to whatever's in the phone booths at WeWork.
These ones have formaldehyde in them?
Supposedly.
Awesome.
I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Tuesday, October 15th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the Nasdaq market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Let's talk about LeBron James. Can we do that?
Yes.
Because that's a serious thing this morning.
Yeah, okay.
LeBron James had some choice words for Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey. Asked about the NBA's ongoing dispute with China, the star player said he believes Morey was either misinformed or not really educated on the situation. James was praised on social media in China for the comments, as you might imagine. But guess what? He was criticized deeply right here in the United States, with some tweeting emoji bags of money at him. LeBron then followed up on Twitter saying, "I do not believe there was any consideration for the consequences and ramifications of the tweet. I'm not discussing the substance. Others can talk about that." He continued a second tweet, "My team in this league just went through a difficult week. And I think people need to understand what a tweet or statement can do to others. And I believe nobody stopped and considered what could happen, what would happen, could have waited a week to send it." So part of what he's suggesting there is, had Morey sent this a week after, I think, they and others were out of the country, the NBA was out of the country, that maybe it would have been okay.
The other thing I'll say is that if you read into the reporting on this, LeBron got up last week in China in a meeting with the NBA and with the players who were there and said, "Wait a second, you want us to go out and talk about this?"
Right.
"And you all haven't even put out a comprehensive statement yourself. You shouldn't be asking us to speak on this behalf until you've come up with your plan and we have kind of a coordinated effort." And I can understand that feeling, like you kind of got hung out to dry on some of this. And the league is saying, you go
also,
out and deal with this.
He's saying, "Thank you, Adam Silver, for being so thoughtful about your response." Whereas Ted Cruz or other people we've had on the show said, "You know, Adam Silver, you were so obsequious."
Yes.
And
But think about who was working for who.
Adam
works for LeBron.
And the money involved.
But LeBron, to some degree, works for Adam.
Yeah, but to appease the CCP is
no,
is
I understand
really
that. That's
bad.
What I'm saying.
Yes.
In a world without money, which there is no such thing, in a world without money, you would never do that. You would never.
What I'm saying
so
is
clear
LeBron,
exactly what LeBron is talking about.
But LeBron's doing it right there.
Yeah, I know, but it's so clear
Steve
what
Kerr's
it's about.
Doing
and I'm not saying
Steph
that
Curry's
companies
doing
don't,
it.
Right, pop of it. All of them. I know. I understand, and I understand.
They
how
all
the
have
world
a lot of contracts,
works.
But I do think the league could have orchestrated a better.
Could
response.
Still have a little hint of cynicism about how everything and it's
no,
US corporations
I,
and everything.
It's all
else.
Money. 100%
MBS. Hey, got our arm around him now. I mean, it's
sure, but then you got to call out everybody. That's part of the issue. I'm not saying not to. I'm saying do it.
Yeah.
But then I don't know.
The NBA is in a tough spot.
That are in the target.
550 million fans in one
at
country.
At least. But yeah, this is the world that we now live in. This multinational world. But if you're an American company, do you stand up and say America first?
And you shouldn't take any. You know, Schadenfreude that the wokest of the woke leagues suddenly kind of got bitten in the rear end by their wokeness.
But so you are.
I said no one should. You heard me. I said no one should.
But there were people who have said to him, you know the quote, "Shut up and dribble."
I knew.
Yeah.
Right?
I
mean, that's the other side of this.
Or you could say shut up and act to the ones in Hollywood. I mean, whatever you want. Shut up and read the prompter is what I'd say to you right now. Let's get out of here.
I'm not saying shut up.
I know, because you're very woke. I know that.
No,
so you're woke, read the prompter.
an update on the WeWork saga. There's a new report out, but I can tell you about this, based on some of the sources that I've spoken to in the last 24 hours, that there is now a major fight going on inside WeWork about which way to lean in terms of the potential next step. And there are many inside that are leaning towards a $5 billion financing effort that would be led by J.P. Morgan rather than selling a controlling stake to SoftBank. Shares of SoftBank rose on that report, by the way, that Bloomberg put out, suggesting that actually J.P. Morgan would be the offer that would be taken.
Why? But I mean, I guess the point is the people internally would lose their stake, would lose their controlling.
It's going to dilute.
It dilutes everybody else's.
It's by default. If SoftBank comes in and takes control, everybody else
gets
pushed out. The question is,
but SoftBank already has 30%, so they have a major vote at the table to see what happens. It depends on who gets washed out where.
Who gets washed out where? That's really the question. Right. Who gets washed out where? And whether if you take the JPM deal, there's a high risk involved, right? Will they be able to pay the debt back?
Right.
How's that whole thing going to be
structured?
How's that
deal being put together? JP Morgan's on the hook for all of it?
Well, that's the other thing. This isn't JP Morgan's balance sheet. JP Morgan's going to go out and market this to other investors.
Because there are other investors who seem like they'd be hot to trot to get into this right now after the IPO fell
as
apart.
On the debt side, potentially. You're smiling with a sort of cynical grin.
You were saying which way they're going to... I think lean forward. They can't do... That's taken, isn't it?
Yes.
I think,
okay. It is.
All right, so
but
they can't... Is it still taken?
By a sister network, I think.
Do they still use that?
I don't know.
Never understood. I was always sort of trying
it's
to
better
understand.
Better than leaning back. Get out of the way.
You got to lean in if you're Sheryl Sandberg, right?
Okay. Separately, the Guardian newspaper reporting that WeWork is expected to lay off at least 2,000 people just this week. That would be about 13% of the staff employees reportedly told the Guardian that little to no work is getting done. And the new projects at WeWork have been put on hold. And then there's another new headache for the company as well. It closed about 2,300 phone booths at its sites in the U.S. and Canada after it discovered elevated levels of a carcinogen. The phone booths are quiet, private places for people to make calls in shared workspaces, for those of you who have not been densified yet. WeWork notified. You know that's what they're calling it? Densification. So people are going from multiple floors to less floors, but open plan, and then they do these kind of little phone booths.
Yeah, I've seen them all over the place.
That's the euphemism. Anyway,
these ones have formaldehyde in them?
Supposedly, formaldehyde has been found. We were notified tenants that elevated levels of formaldehyde have been linked to cancer. If there's long-term exposure, declined to comment on the cost of replacing those phone booths.
How did that happen? It was just made somewhere that...
This part I do not know. I can tell you about the financing. I can't tell you about the formaldehyde.
It's like locus landing on this company on top of everything else that it's dealing with right now.
But think, there are people who spend lots of time in those phone booths.
Really?
Yeah.
Superman.
No, not
actually,
Superman.
He doesn't spend a lot of time. He's
pretty quick.
He's going to be on today.
He's quick.
Robert Frank.
Earnings just coming in from BlackRock, and it looks like they earned $7.15 a share. That's better than the street was anticipating. And as of the end of the third quarter, this is a company that has $6.964 trillion in assets under management,
and
which was alluded to.
This company's CEO will join us live in a few minutes for an extended interview.
Who is Larry Fink?
Thank you. There he is.
Thank you. And
for those
apparently
of you who weren't watching Jeopardy last night, we'll pull you into a little
live,
more of this.
Right.
Were you really watching
live? I was
live?
Really watching live. Actually, it might have been 5 minutes delayed. We do scroll through some of the... We don't like to hear about... they're not there that long. If they're going to be there, if it's going to be a James, Jeopardy James or something like that, we listen to
their
stories.
Yeah.
But we don't want to get too attached to them.
Because just show me the numbers.
Let's get the numbers. Because they talk a lot. Alex asks them these inane questions, and they answer.
Yeah.
But the first guy was wrong.
Right?
The first guy...
Oh, really?
BLK, what is it?
What
it was kind of funny because I had to chuckle. It was a $7 trillion in assets company. And the symbol was BLK. And the first guy that answered said, who is H&R Block?
That's an answer for somebody who's not on Wall Street.
Right.
Considering what we pay in taxes, $7 trillion would be small for for the tax preparation. They don't hold the assets for long, right, Andrew? But they may be involved.
Were you excited screaming at the screen like, I know it.
Actually, I was pretty sure if it was a really great company, I was pretty sure it was Blackstone.
Oh, no, don't.
I'm kidding, Larry.
I'll take the world's largest money manager for $6.9 trillion. BlackRock's chairman and CEO Larry Fink joined Squawk Box today for an extended discussion. Here on the podcast, we've teased out the highlights. Here's Andrew.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the IPO market and what that may say about the larger market. Obviously, this WeWorks deal that hasn't, the WeWorks IPO that wasn't, if you will, has the bell rung on the IPO market? What's happening here?
I think what the bell
does it say about where we are.
It really says nothing about the IPO market. It says something about the private growth valuations.
Okay.
I think that's the bigger issue. This is why I believe in public markets. The public markets, it's harder to hide. Reality is shown every 3 months, and this is why having that public exposure and transparency is the best outcome for all companies to continue.
One of the things that's so interesting is firms like BlackRock, which historically invested solely in the public markets, now some public, typically what might be described as public market investors, are getting access through some of your funds to private markets.
That's true.
How should they think about that? Especially when you have situations like an Uber, which in the private market was valued one way and all of a sudden comes into the public market and falls.
It's a wake-up call for these private valuations. I mean, there was certainly way too much money flooding into the private growth valuations. And I think it's being reset. There was a mantra about growth at all cost. First of all, and I actually believe that is a bad culture that these companies are persisting. Because if you don't set a culture of building a company, long-term profitability, having a culture of only growth at all costs really produces bad outcomes in the long run. And I really do believe this reset in the private growth valuations. Hopefully, the valuations are going to be more about the real operating concern. And so I think there's going to be a big reset on these valuations.
What do you tell then your managers who've been buying into the private markets? You send to lighten up, let's be more cautious, change our approach.
I think everybody, our investors and every investor needs to change their approach. They need to be much more thoughtful about when companies can make profits. And are these companies real or are they just being sustained by private capital? So I believe this dovetails into everything that goes on related to being a public company. There was this mantra, private companies were staying private longer. I think that's a bad outcome. I think you should be going public sooner, being part of it, to try to respond to that transparency. This is why I've been repeating this, the whole mantra of transparency is a right. very good ingredient to build a.
But you don't think this is a sign or a signal of something larger in the economy or in the markets writ large? Do people say this is are we in 2000 or 2001 or is this 99 or because people sort of look at these things as economic indicators?
I think it's another negative, but the negative I don't think it's that that will carry on throughout the whole economy. It is a negative, but I believe it can be moderated very quickly through this process. And I do believe this is not something that's going to be systemic, but it is a problem.
And Larry, you can make the point that it's cheap. Cheap money is everywhere. And it's just another example of cheap money.
Have negative interest rates and low rates, we're going to see.
Well, this is the malinvestment, perhaps, that everyone's worried about. And if we could be at the front end of figuring out where all the other malinvestment is, couldn't we?
No, I totally agree.
It sounded to me like you thought the market was not overvalued here, though, that you think that there are a lot of good things that are happening out there and the market's not necessarily reflecting that. Am I wrong to?
The market is properly valued overall. I don't see that many extremes. And that's because the central banks are going to be highly accommodative, at least for the coming year. What I worry about is more of 2021 after the elections. And where is the economy thereafter?
Larry, are you a banker that has Warren phobia or not?
I don't have. Right now, I have paid very little attention to the politics right now.
Who are you, Steve Kerr? Ask about China? You haven't thought about Elizabeth?
No, I haven't.
You have no idea Elizabeth Warren might be president, and you run the largest asset manager in the world.
Right,
hasn't even occurred to you.
No, I am not paying attention.
Haven't even thought about it. Have you heard of her?
Not much. I haven't.
Okay. All right, Steve.
It's like you may question that, but I really
really haven't thought about what.
Not yet.
Your shareholders might appreciate it if you gave it some thought about whether there's a Warren presidency.
The election, I promise you, I will.
Oh,
but until we see who are the candidates and what they really stand for after the primaries, I'll pay a lot more attention.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry you didn't like that answer.
I don't care.
The debates tonight.
I don't care.
He will not be watching the debates tonight. Okay.
He's watching Jeopardy.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, Elizabeth Warren has a tax plan for that. We'll hear from one of the French economists behind the presidential candidate's tax the rich proposals.
The top optimal rate for taxing the very rich is 60%, 75%.
For the top 1%, at least, 60%.
This is Squawk Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
Stand Joe by in 3, 2, 1. Good, Joe.
Two economists have emerged as some of the most important influencers in the Democratic campaign. They've helped Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders create their wealth taxes. And Robert Frank joins us with the story, which we've talked about before.
Yes. And this now exact, we have them in the flesh here
yes,
on set. They are the new economic architects of taxing the rich. The two most important economists in the Democratic race, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman, helped Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders create both of their wealth taxes. Now, Warren's plan would tax the wealth of more than $50 million at 2%, wealth of a billion or more at 3%. Sanders' plan would include rates as high as 8%. They say that under Sanders' plan, the 400 richest Americans could have an effective tax rate of more than 97% on their income. Now, in a new book out today, Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay More, the two professors at the University of California, Berkeley, propose a three-part approach to reducing inequality. First, they would double corporate tax revenues, raising the TAP income tax rate to 60% and the wealth tax of up to 3.5% for billionaires. Now, the current tax code, they say, looks like the tax system of a plutocracy. The wealthy will keep accumulating with hardly any barrier, along with their power and ability to shape policymaking and government for their own benefit. Now, they also launched a website called TaxJusticeNow.org that allows you to plug in different tax rates for the rich and see how they affect revenues and tax rates for every other group. They have faced some criticism for their calculations and data. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers called their revenue estimates for the wealth tax disingenuous and naive. And we'll have them here to talk about it.
Gabriel, welcome. There was an article that was posted, actually it was on the op-ed pages of the New York Times. And in this case, there was no, what normally would happen, there'd be a working paper that you would, a research paper that would lay out how you arrived at some of these numbers, and you didn't do that. You went, I'm wondering why you went straight to an opinion section where people couldn't figure out how you did the numbers. And I'm also wondering how you got some of the numbers, because you do 2018 and those numbers aren't even available yet from the IRS. So there's got to be a lot of assumptions that go into your calculations, which could make them wrong, basically.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for having me. And second, all the data, all the programs, all the computer code, all the technical appendices of our work are online
now
on taxjusticenow.org.
Okay.
And everything is explained in the book. And all of this is based on the research that we've developed, my co-author Emmanuel Saez and I, over the last two decades. So it's based on a lot of rigorous scientific research, but no data series is definitive.
Gabriel,
these are the best estimates
the CBO,
we think.
But the CBO has...
But it could be improved.
Can we talk more broadly about the issue of taxing the wealthy? Do you think there should be a maximum income or a maximum wealth in America?
That idea has a long history in U.S. society. You have to realize that the United States invented sharply progressive income and wealth taxation, with top marginal income tax rates of more than 90% in the post-World War II decades, top estate tax rates of close to 80% from 1930s to 1980s. That's a U.S. invention. That's not a European invention. No continental European country ever had such top marginal income tax rates.
What's your personal answer to that question?
No, the answer is...
Would you go back
wealth,
to that?
What we explain in the book is, extreme wealth concentration is corrosive.
Okay.
So what's
the upper limit then for you?
That's not something for economists to decide.
Let me ask
it's
you
for
this.
The public
okay, then let me ask
decide.
You a separate question, if you'd indulge me for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Because you've helped design effectively the Elizabeth Warren plan, and there's lots of questions about how you could effectuate a plan like that. The biggest issue, of course, is how is that kind of plan not going to be gamed by people? And effectively, how would you, on an annual basis, effectively value each individual's total net worth at any time. By the way, I don't know what you would do with, you know, Michael Jordan's brand on any given year, or frankly, Donald Trump's mm-hmm. brand, given some of the valuations he's. But I mean, how you would actually do that?
So 70-80% of the wealth of the top 0.1% is in listed securities, listed equities, bonds, mutual fund shares. 30-20% is in unlisted equities. In that case, we have a solution. We are saying, first, the IRS should come up with the best valuation possible. And if the taxpayers disagree, they can pay in kind with shares. So if the wealth tax rate is 3%, they give 3% of their shares to the IRS.
So the government would become...
And then the IRS sells the shares on a market and creates the market that's missing.
See, this was an explosive proposal in the book I don't think people have focused on yet. You're saying that the government would become a part owner of these private companies that where there's a disagreement and then try to resell those shares on some kind
resell.
Of auction
so
market.
So the point is not for the government to own shares. It's to resell immediately, but to create the market value that's missing. That's, you know, a service that the IRS could
and provide. And you find that the top optimal rate for taxing the very rich is 60%, 75%? On the Laffer curve, where do you find the optimal rate for taxing the rich?
You know, the revenue maximizing tax rate for the top 1% is at least, you know, 60% in terms of average effective tax rate. But in reality, it depends on enforcement. You know, governments can choose to make taxes fail,
right.
And we've seen a lot of that. Or they can choose to make taxes
work. What would you do with philanthropy? What would you do with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett?
No, that's a good question. That's a debate that you know to have. We don't talk a lot about that in the book. You could have a wealth tax, you know, for foundations, especially for foundations that are controlled by you know, living individuals, by their founders, to prevent, you know, tax avoidance, people moving money to their foundations. You know, that's sometimes
to be
discussed.
To avoid taxes.
No, people giving money away, you have to pay, you know, gift taxes, and if you give to a
Gabriel,
charity,
the methodology itself is...
Thanks for joining us.
Next on Squawk Pod, the existential threat of the rise of Amazon's Jeff Bezos to infinity and way beyond.
One of the things that our founders stayed up late at night sweating about was the concentration of power.
Back after this. You're listening to Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Andrew, bye. Up and Andrew, cue.
Welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan. Amazon recently released a manifesto on a variety of issues on which it has faced criticism, including a minimum wage and also facial recognition technology. For a closer look at Amazon and its founder and CEO, Jeff Bezos, I want to welcome Frank Foer. He's Atlantic Magazine's national correspondent. And he's the author of the magazine's current cover story, A Profile of Jeff Bezos That's Worth the Time, Folks, I Spent With It, titled Jeff Bezos' Master Plan. And Frank spent more than 5 months speaking with current and former Amazon employees for the piece. And Frank, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
For those who haven't read the piece, I'll ask you the question, but I know the answer to some degree already. What was the biggest surprise for you in this reporting process? Because I think that you came to this with some preconceptions, dare I say, that changed in the process.
Right. So I've been a critic of the big technology companies. I've written a book that describes them as an existential threat. And I walked away from the process still extremely concerned about the concentration of power within one corporation and within one man. But I think what surprised me was the extent to which my admiration for the company and fear were so tangled up with one another that when I look at the company, the thing that is so truly impressive is that one guy is able to press his values out through all 600,000 of his employees. And he's created this business that is that's spanning off in all these various different directions, which sometimes seem seemingly disconnected from one another. And yet, what is the thing that connects this massive, sprawling enterprise called Amazon together? It's that they all embody the values of Jeff Bezos. And that is both something to look at in awe and marvel at, and he may be the greatest CEO in the history of American business, but it's also something that's problematic because one of the things that our founders stayed up late at night sweating about was the concentration of power. And they worried about the concentration of power in the executive branch, and they worried about the concentration of power outside of government as well.
So,
and,
I hope he's a good guy.
Well, I was going to ask you two questions. Did you walk away from this experience of reporting it thinking, okay, I like the values of this guy or not?
I like some of his values. I didn't like some of the other values. I mean, I think the point is that you look at something, and I'll give you one example, which is space exploration, which right. is this is an area where the government has basically sat down. We're not really in the business of exploring space anymore. And here's a guy who, from the time that he was in high school, had a vision of what space colonization.
You quote his girlfriend, his high school girlfriend, yeah. saying the reason he wants to make all this money is so that he can go to space.
Right. And that's the thing that he's not especially open in talking about Amazon, but he's very open in talking about his company Blue Origin and what he wants to do. And it's a utopian vision for how we'll all live in these giant cylindrical tubes stationed between the moon and Earth. And it's in response to this grave crisis that he sees when the Earth runs out of resources generations from now. And so he's chosen to sell $1 billion of Amazon stock each year in order to fund his right. utopian vision, which is great, except that there are all these questions that we should ask about what happens if he starts to realize his vision. And here's one guy using all of his money to set the terms by which we shape the future of the heavens,
so
which
Frank,
is both.
Here's, yeah. here's my question to you. Having now lived through this reporting process and
yeah.
coming to this with some of the views that you had about breaking up big tech to begin with, has it changed your view?
No. I mean, I, for starters, I think it should be said that when we talk about applying antitrust law to these companies, there's a sledgehammer that we can take, but there are also more subtle things that we can do to deal with their power. For instance, we've just been lax about reviewing mergers over time. And when you look at a company like Amazon, some of its growth is organic and indigenous and stems from the creative genius of the people there. But a lot of times they're just simply buying potential competitors or buying their way into owning various verticals. And so I think without even having to think about what it would like to smash Amazon apart, we could more rigorously apply antitrust enforcement to the company. I also think I think that eventually, Bezos is seeing around corners is going to break up his own company. That AWS exists as its own fantastically profitable business. There's no reason that it needs to be connected to Amazon, the e-retailer. And as he looks at what's happening in politics, where there's this increasing bipartisan consensus that big tech is a problem,
right.
I'm pretty sure he's going to say, all right, fine.
Is that based on just a supposition? Is that based on people?
No, I heard people who are close to Bezos, throw that out there, not necessarily channeling him, but saying that that would be the obvious thing for him to do in the face of this.
It follows what they did with headquarters, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, forget it. Okay, fine. We'll take our ball and go home.
Right, right. Well, and I think when you talk about that different headquarters, one of the things that was interesting to me, and it was a theme in my reporting, was looking at the reasons why they chose to locate outside of Washington, D.C. And you look at AWS and its growth, and you look at the public sector is clearly this huge opportunity for Amazon that they're going after it, not just by uploading the federal government's cloud. They're trying to become a major vendor for the federal government, where the federal government buys water bottles and office seats from Amazon. They're selling facial recognition software to law right. enforcement. And so
how is that effort going in a Trump administration, given some of the comments, obviously, that the president has made that have been largely critical of Jeff Bezos personally, if not the company as well?
It's been a herky-jerky process. I mean, this Jedi contract at the Pentagon has been held up because of this animosity between Trump and Bezos. And I do think that when we step back, I think it's really interesting that we have these two foils, because in some ways they represent divergent responses to the crisis in American democracy, that Trump comes in and he's got his emotional populist appeal. And Bezos represents a different response, which is that when we look at Bezos, we say, all right, well, rather than having this world governed by this emotional populism, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have this utopia of rules and technocracy that Bezos embodies?
So, Frank, is the space exploration gene linked to the billionaire gene? I mean, do you want to go? I don't want to. Do you want to go to space? I'm
no.
scared.
No. No,
they want to go, and they also have $1 billion. Do you think it's a linkage, a gene linkage, or what the hell's with these guys, Branson and Bezos and Musk and everything? I like it here.
Well, look, I do think that there's something beautiful about exploring space and exciting about exploring space, but I don't want to ditch planet Earth.
In terms of existence, it's the one thing humans, I guess, can aspire to and have for thousands of years. I guess I get that, but I want to let someone else do that, I think. I don't know. Maybe
of all the crises that we face right now as a species, I'm not sure that I think escaping from planet Earth ranks as my highest concern.
And no one's won a Malthusian bet yet. Yeah. Not one person has been paid off that's bet on that Malthusian, the thing that you described with Bezos. I mean, a couple hundred years, who knows? I don't know what we'll run out of, but we seem to have maybe we'll go mine an asteroid if we run out of stuff. Anyway. You going to say goodbye to Frank?
I am going to say goodbye.
That's the show for today. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
You have a drinking problem.
I have a coffee problem.
You haven't talked to...
I have a coffee problem. Not a drinking problem.
No, but isn't that...
Show
that's the drink. Yeah, that's the drink.
I spilled
the coffee. You haven't really copped to a drinking problem, but I just watched it, and you were unable to do it.
The problem was that the liquid decided to go down my tie and face.
It's a drinking problem. It's a good kind of drinking problem to have.
We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.